Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. It's safe to say that Tommy Orange's powerful and urgent Native American voice has exploded onto the landscape of contemporary fiction. His highly anticipated debut novel, There, There, interweaves the experiences of 12 people who gather in Oakland for a powwow. It is a multi-generational story about violence and recovery, hope and loss. He writes of the plight of the urban Native American, the Native American in the city, in a novel that grapples with a complex and painful history, with an inheritance of beauty and profound spirituality, and with the plague of addiction, abuse, and suicide. Tommy Orange is a recent graduate from the MFA program at the Institute of American Indian Arts. He is a 2014 McDowell Fellow and a 2016 Writing by Writers Fellow. He's an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. Again, the new novel is There, There. We welcome Tommy Orange to this week's book show. What a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
At what point did you know that the idea of writing about the urban Native American was something that you wanted to address and ultimately, it seems, fill a void?
I came to writing pretty late and reading as well. And the early stuff that I wrote was pretty experimental and weird. Once I started thinking about including details of my own life in my work, that immediately meant the urban Indian experience. And I also worked in that community for many years and just was very aware of it not being very well known in the literary world or in the, you know, in movies. And our depictions of us just seem to lack an update.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's convenient for people to think of us as gone or past tense because we don't want to have to face the ugly truth of what happened.
So when it comes to the community now that is here, what do you think most people are missing? And is the community, that urban Native American community, together enough and forceful enough to have people notice?
Part of the issue with invisibility for Native people is that we're a small population, and we're a small population for a very specific reason. And the urban Indian populations in cities across the country, they're relatively small as well. I don't know that they're based on any of this, that it's going to become a more visible community. I hope that, you know, if a book can have that kind of effect in reality, that's the hope, but I don't know if that will be true.
You write about a powwow, there are 12 specific characters, and how they come to this particular event. What was it about the powwow that not only brings these characters together, but ultimately brings, in the real world, the community together?
There's a parallel between what a powwow is and what an urban Indian is. And powwows are relatively a newer thing. It's not something that comes from, you know, way back when. People started doing it, I believe, after World War II is when they really started happening in a big way. And they pull from different cultures and traditions. But what I love about them is that, so for that, they're relatively new as a thing. They're intertribal, which urban areas with Indian communities tend to be intertribal. And we're very visible and loud there. And so when you're there at a powwow, you just sort of can feel part of what it means to be Native.
The novel begins with the prologue, and this is really a baseline knowledge for us as the reader to understand where we're about to go. There is the prologue in the novel. There is also an interlude. These are almost essays as to, here is information that you should know about this Native American experience. Did you write that very early on, or was that something that you went back to try to fill in the blanks?
There are certain things that I always knew that I wanted to write in the book, that I wanted a whole bunch of characters, that I wanted it to converge at a powwow, that I wanted to write about this particular community and that I wanted a prologue. I knew that early on because I like prologues and I like just what they can do in a novel, how they can contextualize the characters you're about to sort of walk through their lives with them or as them. But I also like that you can skip a prologue if you don't like them, and you can go back as you get involved with the characters, and then they'll inform your reading at that point. So I just like the malleable nature of what a prologue can do in a book. But also for native people, there's just a sense that you can't even start to hear the story if you're not hearing the way we experience history and the way we think about it. So to enter in sort of knowing what native people know and the way we experience history is different than most Americans, the way they think about history and the, you know, the noble forefathers. And there's a certain way that we like to think of history and keeping it sort of clean. And for Native people, we just experienced it very differently. And so wanting the reader to enter the lives of these characters with, like you said, the baseline of what we experience, how we experience history.
There does seem to be a quality to it of, okay, look. Hey, look, this is what you need to know.
Yeah, I mean, I think I even have that frank tone when I talk about how, you know, the image of us rolling heads down temple stairs is very convenient to make us seem like insane savages. The way they frame it is to make us seem like we were animals, and wiping us out or fixing us was the only thing to do. And so most Native people, and I didn't want to just say something that other Native people had already heard before. I didn't want to say it in a boring sort of like history book way. This is what I like about fiction, is that you can write about history, and everyone's calling it an essay, but I fully intended the prologue to be part of, you know, the fiction. So because I wanted to write sentences the way I think about in fiction, just sort of in a way that's being frank about what happened, so that Native audiences would, even though if they knew the information, they would still enjoy the way it was being told. So that's kind of why I had that tone.
One of the things that struck me in reading the prologue was that image of the Indian with the test pattern of the television screen that you would see in late 50s, 60s television, where the station would sign off and there would be a test pattern, and then on the top there was the Indian head. And that just struck me because I've seen it, but it never made that connection. And it's really something that stayed with me. But the real thing that I kept on thinking of, why did they ever do that?
They put our heads on spikes in front of colonies as a symbol of victory and of, you know, don't mess with us. Maybe it's a very, like, not to use a loaded word, but primitive way to be. It's interesting that our heads are on jerseys to this day, and they refuse to take them off, and that this Indian head mysteriously ended up on the test pattern, and nobody really knows why. When you do the research, nobody knows why it's there. On the back of the artwork, it's somebody named Brooks. It just says Brooks. It felt like, you know, from the act of putting a head on a spike to, like, somehow accidentally Indian head still showing up broadcast, there just felt like something fitting, you know, the sort of an unconscious continuation of the Indian head thinking that originally was, like, very purposeful, and eventually it's just something that people are complicit with without really knowing why.
Tommy Orange is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the debut novel is There, There. The title comes from a Gertrude Stein quote. At what point did you come along and realize that was written about Oakland and that it was saying something to you in regards to this novel?
It was pretty early on that I knew that quote was going to be meaningful, because it's about Oakland and because that quote gets used in a way that talks bad about Oakland when that's not what she was doing. She was talking about where she grew up. There's no more there because it had been developed over. So talking about location and change and memory, and the parallels with Native experience, and how are we to think of the there that was once there, and how are we to make the there in Oakland ours, and where we ended up after all these years, to think about environment in a different way and home in a different way. So there was just so many resonances loaded when I found that. I know it was before 2014. It was just a couple years into writing, but I can't remember the moment. It was a big moment, though.
12 characters, the range in age, we have children, we have adolescents, we have people who are middle age, we have older characters in this novel. I assume you always wanted that range.
I really didn't know what the range was going to be. The idea to write this kind of novel, like I said, I knew a lot of characters. I like what a chorus of voices can do for a singular vision in a novel, and when I've read that before, I just like what that is. And I knew I wanted them all to converge at the powwow. I knew that much information. The first year of writing it, I was just writing new characters almost every day. And who ended up staying were the ones that were most compelling to me and that seemed to have the staying power and the distinction to be different from one another. The fact that it ended up displaying a range, I'm very happy with how that happened. But I didn't set out to say, like, I'm going to write young and old and in order to write about the range of people. But it turned out that way, so I'm happy that it did.
Also, you're writing in the first, second, and third person voice, which is interesting too.
I feel like it's a little bit of a cheat in regards to distinction. So if you're in the second, or let's say you're in the third for a whole chapter and you get to know somebody's life, not only are you changing the way you write sentences and you're changing the details of a character's life, but if you switch POV, you're just making sure that no characters are going to mix them up. And part of the challenge of writing about with so many protagonists is that you don't want, you know, their voices to blend together, then you get them all mixed up. And the minute you lose a reader, you risk them stopping reading the book. So I really wanted to make each character as distinct as I could because I knew the risk of writing about so many different characters.
In the second person is really, I think you do it once in the novel, right? And it is when you come upon it somewhat, I wouldn't say jarring exactly, but it's stark in the way that it comes out.
Well, and yeah, and I made the only second person that's a character named after me. Thomas Frank is my those are my first two names. And it's not, I don't share all the biographical details with that character, but it definitely started out as me, sort of a fictional version of me with a lot of the same biographical details. And the voice came flying out. It was written in the third first. And there's something about seeing my name on the page and it transformed the way I approached how I wrote the character. Because I transposed most of the characters into different POVs for experimentation to see which one felt the most right. It was very tedious work. But when I transposed that one into the second, and the idea of making the reader sort of be me, there was something that I really liked about that.
When it comes to your writing, without giving anything away, you write about violence and violent acts in this book. I was struck in how you write about the process of dying, of maybe dying, of maybe not dying, and that moment where life is still in your body and when life leaves your body. And when you come to this section of the novel, it is amazing to me because it's so reflective of earlier passages where the characters are confronting who they are and if they are valid or not. And I assume that that is something that you consciously wanted to look at. That idea of writing about death, I have never experienced, as a reader, I have never experienced someone writing in that way, in such a detailed tone of that process and what that must be like, especially for multiple characters.
I think this is directly related to how often I die in dreams. So I've died lots of times in dreams and lots of times from gunfire. So I've gone through the process of whatever my brain thinks that would be like. I've gone through it maybe more than most people, or I don't know how many people dream of dying and don't talk about it, but largely that comes from having dreamed it a lot. I grew up with a pretty intense relationship to dreams and to the end of the world being possible, and with a Christian evangelical background on my mom's side. So that intensity, the spiritual intensity in which I grew up, informed whatever part of me that made me dream a lot, and especially dream about dying. The fact that I did that was directly related to how often I've experienced it in dreams.
most of us, I think it's safe to say, most of us fear death. Do you feel more understanding of it and less fearful of it because you feel that you have in some way already experienced aspects of it?
I mean, I think it would be false to say that I'm not afraid of dying. At the same time, because I've experienced it in so many different ways and in so many different contexts, I do have a different relationship to it. And I don't know if I could explain it, but it does feel, I do feel a dynamic relationship with the possibility of death.
So this is just me, but if I'm having a lot of dreams about death, I seek a therapist quickly. So do you have that necessity, or that the writing actually helps you in sort of understanding it?
Well, you know, it's been happening since I was a kid, and you know, therapy was not even part of the language of what we talked about doing about it. The doing about it, it never felt clear to me what to do. But the writing for sure helps and is cathartic. And I feel that I need to write. There's a certain amount that I've found that if I get to it, the day is okay. I have a thing with writing and running where if I can get to a certain amount, which I don't always get to, I really feel like sane and other times very much less sane. And regarding finding therapy, I do want to find some, but I haven't been able to afford it in the past, and now I can, and I'm very open to it, if that's what you're suggesting for me.
not suggesting that at all. I was telling you that I would immediately seek it out if I was having it, because I was always, I remember my parents telling me very young, well, you'll never dream that you actually die. And so I find that interesting that you've had that. I've come close in my dreams, but never to that moment.
I had one that was particularly disturbing where I died far enough into the death of it where I actually felt this really intense relief, like all the weight that you carry that you don't know that you carry was gone. And it was one of the best feelings I've ever felt. So it's kind of a scary thing to feel because I don't want to die. But I felt it, and it sort of went that far into the whatever my imagination made of death, that it would be like this great relief.
So in no way am I trying to play therapist here, but so sociologically speaking, instead of psychologically speaking, this idea, the plagues that you write about in this book of abuse and addiction and suicide, do you think that plays a role in the urban Native American, that association with death and the brevity of life?
I don't know. I mean, I think if there are aspects of mental health and issues that I address, it's largely related to working in a mental health department. I was a data entry coordinator for many years in the urban Indian community in Oakland. So seeing real numbers and, you know, the things that affect us, I think that was related. I went to a lot of conferences. I heard a lot of speeches at mental health conferences, national mental health conferences. So I came to understand sort of just on a data level what we're going through, and eventually was able to convert that into literature because I didn't want to, you know, become preachy or like, this is what we face, you all need to know this. But there is a sense, you know, that if you can do it in the right way, you can relay information to people in a compelling way. I say in the prologue, like, we continue to be thought of a certain way, even though you could easily look up everything I looked up. I only researched on the internet, and you know, through experience I know stuff, and yet people don't. And in the age of information and in the age of fake news, I think art and literature plays a really big role in convincing people of things and moving people to change and to think and to consider what this all is.
The micro, of course, is looking at the urban Native American. The macro also is looking at gun violence in this country. It's looking at suicide. It's looking at the issues of opioid abuse, drug abuse. Those are subjects, obviously, that you're tackling here as well that then become universal for the reader.
Yeah, I mean, I think I didn't consciously say, now I'm going to write about addiction problems, and now this chapter's about suicide, and how am I going to dress my characters up to convince people to think about these issues. It just came through when I went to write. It just happened to be with these characters, their context. So I'm happy that they were able to be worked in and it's being received well and read well. And I'm happy that it's hitting on a seemingly more universal, in a more universal way. I think there's something about delving deep into specificity that does a trick of getting to the universal that may or may not be the reason why people are connecting to it.
There's two words that you just used I found fascinating. One is trick, and the other one is this idea of not preaching, of non-preachiness. The section, there's a beautiful passage that you write about regarding guns. This comes out of this idea of a 3D print of a gun. And using that very cool idea allows you to explore, because you even remove the color from the object. It brings you very deep into the idea of what a gun can do and its importance or its symbolic importance in our culture.
Yeah, and I think there are certain elements of what I ended up writing about that, and I don't want to sound like woo-woo or, you know, mystical or like I'm a skeptic about most things and I doubt a lot. There was something about a 3D printed gun, and when I did the research and saw how far along we are, that just, there's a feeling, it's almost an instinctual thing. There were certain details and research facts that I found out about, like the Indian head, that just something in my gut said, like, there's a lot here, there's layers here. And I like to work in layers, and I think it's more interesting to me when things are doing more than one thing at once while you're experiencing it. And I think what all that you just explained about the 3D printed guns is whatever my instinct said, there's something here, include this. And I think, you know, that may be another element is why readers are connecting to it like they are.
On the cover of the book, Margaret Atwood has a quote saying an astonishing literary debut. It says in the first paragraph of the jacket, it introduces a brilliant new author at the start of a major career. On the back, there are several sections here as a new writer with an old heart. Remember his name, his book's going to blow the roof off. Well, that's nice pressure for you, isn't it? I mean, how the hell do you follow that up?
Yeah, I mean, Pam Houston, who said the roof off thing, she was my mentor at my MFA program the last semester, and she saw the thesis. At the time, it was the first 120 pages of the book. I don't know how she knew that it would do well, or I don't know exactly. You know, she's been around for a long time. She's a very talented writer and teacher, and she's a great human being. There's no way, it's so unprecedented and so not even dreamed for. Like, maybe if I was, you know, if I spent my life as a writer and a reader and I thought one day I'd be in the New Yorker and that was my dream, so once it happens, maybe I'd know how to react better. The only thing I can do is be baffled and grateful. I'd try to ground myself in gratitude and not sound like a buffoon with microphones in front of me.
And at some point, you know, and then I would worry of, oh God, I hope I don't become so successful that I stop dreaming that I'm going to die.
I haven't had that. Well, no, that's not true. It's, you know, it's at least once a month. I had when the Hawaiian volcano happened, I had a really extended period of dying in hot lava. That was sort of like, I was just like, it wasn't burning. Every time, like, my brain seems to tell me that, which is maybe true, we don't know, that the brain will, like, sort of sedate you in your worst pain. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of stories about people who go through physical trauma, it's like they didn't really feel it, or they felt some version of it, but it was like, you know, the brain does something to help. So I was burning in lava for a really long time recently, just for some reason related to the Hawaiian volcano.
And then you wake up.
Always wake up so far.
The name of the new novel is There, There. It is published by Knopf. Tommy Orange, what a great pleasure. This is one of the most amazing novels I've read this year, and it's one of the most amazing novels I've ever read, and I thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for your time and for reading it.
It's a great pleasure. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.